I have a very good friend who owns a number of radio stations, two of which carry my daily broadcasts, I'm happy to say, and I'm working on the other two. My friend is also a graduate of the esteemed Harvard Business School and, as you might expect, a very successful and very likable man. He has a beautiful wife and five beautiful children, but he's unable to speak a single sentence the meaning of which another rational human being can ascertain. That is, he's one of those people with good minds who have a very clear picture of what they're trying to communicate, and because the picture is so clear to them, they assume that you also have a clear picture of it. For example, my friend might say, and will say, "Well, as I feared, he's in big trouble." You wait, and nothing further is forthcoming. My friend knows who's in trouble and exactly what the trouble is. Therefore, he assumes, on the amount of information he's given you, that you know what he knows. But you don't. So after a pause, you ask, "Okay, who's in big trouble?" My friend will look at you with raised eyebrows as though you're a near moron and say, "Why, Bill Jones, of course." You then ask, "What kind of trouble?" Again, the startled look and the amazed explanation. "His warehouse burned to the ground the other night." Talking with my very good friend is an exercise in futility, and the meaning of what he's trying to say must be dragged out of him piecemeal until you're able to put the whole story together like a jigsaw puzzle. After a while, you just nod and smile, and he goes on talking only to himself. The fact that you know what you want to say and know your subject matter well is fine, but don't make the mistake of thinking the audience knows what you want to say or is as familiar with the subject or even knows about the subject. Make sure that your sentences are complete, that you have the who, why, what, when, and how in your talk. Don't assume anything. I have a little sign in my desk drawer sent to me by a good friend which reads, "Assumption is the mother of all foul-ups." Assume nothing. Don't say he or she when you can use the name. Never use that mongrel expression, "you know," or its first cousin, "you know what I mean." No, they don't know what you mean. Our job is to tell them what we mean in clear, easily understood, and very good English. Don't, like my good friend, say something ended in disaster. Tell us what kind of disaster. When we're standing up there in front of all those people, we're in the role of the reporter. We want to say what we want to say in an interesting, colorful, and effective manner. There's no room for ambiguity. There's some very good advice about writing a novel. It goes, "Be clear, be clear, be clear, but not too clear." Now, that's fine for a novel, but it won't work for making speeches. There it has to read, "Be clear, be clear, be clear, be clear." That's what speaking is all about, to transfer the picture from your mind, the whole picture with all the parts attached, into the minds of your listeners. There's something that Kipling wrote about the savage who stood up in ancient times in the firelight one night and told his companions about the hunt that day. And as he spoke and gesticulated and walked up and down, the hunt came alive for them again, and finally they rose up and killed him, for there was magic in his words, and they were afraid. Now, I don't have that exactly right, but that was the gist of it. Yes, there is magic in words, properly strung together and effectively, movingly delivered. But there's nothing more exasperating to an audience than the speaker who leaves too much to the imagination or makes the assumption the audience has the picture as clearly as he or she does. Then the audience wants to rise up and kill him. Former President Richard Nixon was famous for his comment, "I want to be very clear about this." Now, when we hear a politician say that, we get our defenses up. It's like the merchant who says he's got a store-wide sale on at cost. Whose cost? Our cost, not his. You don't have to tell the audience you want to be very clear. Just be clear. Make sure your talk has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and that there are no lingering doubts in anyone's mind as to what you had to say, what your message was. Now, this includes enunciating clearly and speaking at the right rate of speed, not too slow, by all means, but not too fast either. We should speak at a good rate. The minds of our listeners can move a whole lot faster than we can talk, and as long as our words and meaning can be clearly understood, we can sail along at a good fast clip. It helps hold the audience's attention. There's no time for their minds to wander, and the speech is more interesting delivered at a good rate. Not rapid fire, but at a good rate of speed, about the rate of speed at which I'm speaking here. The ends of words should be spoken as clearly as their beginnings, and suddenly dropping your voice for dramatic effect might leave a large portion of your audience in the dark as to what you said. When you speak more softly, you must move closer to the microphone. If you're going to yell about something, move back so that your voice isn't distorted and your audience's ears offended. In speaking at a good rate of speed, make certain that you're not running your words together too much. You know, when we listen to someone who speaks clearly and interestingly, we're not even aware of the words he's using at all, just as you're not really aware of the words I'm using here. We listen for ideas. We pluck ideas from the stream of narrative as we catch fish from a flowing river. The words make the ideas clear. They flavor our speech like good seasoning flavors a meal. They convince, they sell our ideas. So the words that we use are very important. But they're used in such a way that just the ideas come through, just as the hundreds of brushstrokes of a fine painting are invisible in themselves, yet together they form the message the artist wants to convey. When our speech is in preparation, it's a good time to ask ourselves, will this talk make my ideas as clear to the audience as they are to me? That's why it's said that the good speaker tells his audience what he's going to say, then he says it, and then he tells them what he said. When he's through, the message has been transferred from his mind to the minds of his audience. And that's about what this business of speaking before a group is all about. When we're talking to subordinates at work or to our kids, we can use the excellent device of good communications and ask them to tell us, in their own words, what we've told them we want them to do. It's also a good idea with waitresses. Quite often, as we listen to what they heard us say, we find it's different from what we meant to say. Somehow we fail to get the message across as we wanted to. Speaking before an audience does not give us that luxury. We get feedback, to be sure. If we're sensitive, we know at every stage of our talk how the audience is reacting. But we can't ask them to tell us what we said. We've got to do it right the first time. Don't assume anything. Assumption is the mother of all foul-ups. Tell them, and tell them clearly. Thank you. Are you familiar with the definition of the word marketing? The difference between the words selling and marketing is that selling has to do with selling what you've got to sell, whether it fits the needs of your market or not. Marketing, on the other hand, is so designing your product that it will fit the needs of the marketplace. Marketing is the taking of your market into consideration before you produce the product or service. And marketing also takes in every function involved in moving a product from the warehouse or the manufacturing plant to the hands and home of the customer. It includes advertising, the training of people, public relations, point-of-sale material, the whole thing. The more successful a company's marketing department, the more successful a company. The good speaker prepares his talk with his market in mind. That's why the good speaker won't make the same talk to a high school graduation that he'll make to the Chamber of Commerce. He designs his product to fit the needs of his market. Do you remember the old adage in selling that goes, get on the customer's side of the desk? The idea was good. It meant that we'll do a better job if we can remove that desk from standing between us. If we can get our chair around closer to the customer and speak from his point of view. Again, it's the same with making a good and interesting speech. We have to get on the other side of the podium and sit with the audience. What are they thinking? What are they most interested in? What can we do to stimulate their interest in what we want to sell today? It isn't a matter of manipulation. It's just good sense. It's the way to succeed with people. What do the people in your audience want? Well, we may not know the specific things they want and are working toward, but chances are they're much the same things that we want and are working toward. We do know what people in our society want in a general way. They want three things, and they want them in this order. Number one, recognition. In preparing a talk, and certainly in giving it, it's good to remember that the people in our audience want recognition more than anything else. It's a good idea to begin with that. Say something that indicates you're familiar with your audience and what they've accomplished and so on. Incidentally, these three factors I'm talking about apply to all people. They apply to our kids, our spouses, our neighbors, fellow workers, and customers. Number one, recognition. Number two, stimulation or change, the opposite of boredom. Everyone wants change in his life. Not so much that it threatens him in any way, but change all the same. Change from the ordinary. That's why people trade in brand new or nearly new cars after a few months or a year or two. They want change, and they'll pay for it. Keep this factor in mind while preparing your speech. A good way to make sure you're doing that is to avoid all cliches in your talk and put something interesting and different into it. And three, people want security. But in our society, security's in third place. Security comes in many forms. There are those who want to be secure in our love, those who want to be secure in what we say, in our integrity, in the integrity of our product or service. Then there's financial security, desired by everyone. It's good in preparing and delivering a speech to know that your audience, while composed of original individuals, has these three universal desires: recognition, change, and security. By working those factors into our presentation, we're speaking from the audience's side of the podium. Having this information also helps us avoid that awful feeling known as stage fright, sometimes described as a feeling of worthlessness. It's characterized by the unspoken question, what am I doing here talking to these people? What right do I have to stand up there and make a speech to all those intelligent people out there? Knowing their feet are composed of the same clay as ours helps. Knowing they have the same universal desires we have can give us the confidence we need. I've heard speakers say that in the beginning, it helped them to visualize audiences sitting there in their underwear. The mental picture of all those bony knees and hairy legs, on the men at least, helped them realize that those people out there are really not much different from you and me. They want really what you and I want. They want to be seen and recognized as original human beings, which they are, just as do our kids and the woman we love. They want us to look at them as individuals and to be aware of what they're trying to tell us. Now, we can empathize with people like that, can't we? We know how they feel because we're one of them. Then let us speak to that primary need in those who turn their faces and attention toward us. That's why speaking to people in groups carries with it a good deal of responsibility, if we're aware of it. Because of the heterogeneous makeup of audiences, never say anything that can offend a minority group or a particular religion. Never tell a joke that in any way demeans a person belonging to a special group or participate in cruel generalizations because it might bring a laugh from a regional audience. That's a cheap, unmanly way to do things. Never think that because the group you're making the butt of your jokes doesn't have a member present in your audience that you won't offend anyone. You will. The better educated, more sensitive people in your audience will be deeply offended, and no matter what you may subsequently say, they're not going to go along with you. Irish, Polish, Swedish, Jewish, black jokes should be banned from human society. They're simply ridiculous and have no basis whatever in fact. Avoid them. Never use them. If you want to get laughs by poking fun at someone, use the Jack Benny technique and make yourself the fall guy. The laughs will be genuine and no one will ever be offended. It's just the old golden rule. Sit in the audience in your mind, get on that side of the podium, and speak to those good people the way you'd like to be spoken to. Thank you. Perhaps you've heard the story of the man who invented the perfect dog food. It was the most nutritious dog food the world had ever known. It was guaranteed to prolong the life of your pet, give it bright, clear eyes, a rich, silky coat, strong bones and teeth, and even extend its barking range. There was just one problem. The dogs wouldn't eat it. We all remember funny and far-out advertising campaigns that had the whole country laughing, but tests after the campaign showed no appreciable gain in sales. The test of all communication is, does it sell the product? Now, this kind of rule can, of course, be abused. Tedious, ridiculous, and hateful ad campaigns have been excused by the advertising people who say, well, it sells the product. Selling the product is the idea, but not at all costs. Not at the cost of good taste, good manners, or good morals. But still, we must sell the product. And that's where burning the midnight oil comes into play. That's where study, experience, trial and error, deep knowledge, education, all count in our favor. We want to sell our ideas, but we don't want to get so cute or clever in doing so that the people concentrate on the smokescreen and fail to get the point of it all, fail to see and or buy what we're trying to sell, the reason for all the sound and fury. Originality and creativity are of tremendous importance here. Remember, in an earlier message, we learned that the worst sin of the salesman is to be uninteresting. Now, that applies to the preacher and his sermon, the father or mother talking to the kids, selling them on the good life, the better way to live, pitfalls to avoid. It applies to selling ourselves to our superiors and our fellow workers and subordinates. And it applies to the actual selling of our organization's product or service. Now, when we accept an invitation to make a speech, as I just did this morning, we accept the challenge to sell our ideas to others. Our main purpose is to get the people to buy what we have to say. We're not trying to win prizes as orators, arm swingers, or podium thumpers. We're there to sell the people on an idea, to transfer our enthusiasm for our subject to our listeners. That's why I think it's a good idea to go easy on the jokes. I remember reading a Toastmasters critique of a speaker. He was supposed to be talking about the importance of vocabulary, as I remember it, but instead regaled his audience with funny stories. In the critique, the Toastmaster admitted that the man was very funny, but said he didn't say anything about the importance of vocabulary. He had forgotten completely what he was there to talk about. Either that, or he didn't know anything about the importance of vocabulary and just got up and told a bunch of funny stories. Now, that's like sending your son to the store to buy a can of paint and have him come home with a bunch of bananas. It doesn't make any sense. Jokes have their place. In all speeches, except those of a very serious nature, there are perfectly natural places for a funny line or two. Adding that line and getting the audience to laugh and relax is good, but it should remain subsidiary to your theme and purpose. If it will help sell your idea or impress it more effectively in the minds of your listeners, fine, use it. If it's just a joke without any relationship to your subject, I'd say keep it out. If there is the slightest doubt in your mind as to whether or not to use a funny line or a joke, by all means leave it out. When it's right, you'll know it. It will fit like a glove. It'll be perfect. After giving a speech, it would be great if we could poll the members of the audience and ask them a few questions. In one sentence, what was the theme of my talk? And then the big question, did you buy what I talked about here today? I had a man come up to me at a social gathering not long ago. He introduced himself and said, I've heard you speak, Mr. Nightingale, and you make a very interesting talk. I don't buy what you're selling, but it's an interesting talk. I immediately put him down as a crackpot or a total moron, but I smiled, shook his hand, and said something such as, well, you can't sell everybody. But I felt a stab of failure all the same, and I knew he wasn't a moron. Crackpot, maybe. It's hard for us to imagine that any rational person on the face of the globe could find disagreement with our devastating logic, supported as it is with indisputable facts and buttressed with overwhelming reason. But they do. Some of them do. I wanted to say to my criticizer, you could have easily come up with a friendlier comment than that, but he was right. He obviously had not bought what I had to say that morning. The applause after my talk had convinced me that I'd made a sale. Obviously, I had not sold everyone, and it helps us to realize it. And you won't either. People who drive a certain make of car can't understand why everyone doesn't drive that make. Republicans are amazed that rational, intelligent human beings can belong to the Democratic Party and vice versa. It drives me up a tree to admit that a good friend of mine is an out-and-out socialist, but he is. People drive dozens of makes of cars, believe in many different ways, are devoutly loyal to hundreds of various religions and sects, and you and I can jump up and down on the stage until we drop over from exhaustion trying to change their beliefs, and very probably to no avail. But when we have something to say, when we've been asked to make a speech, taking all the foregoing messages into consideration, as well as the three to follow, we can do our very best to persuade them to buy what we're trying to sell. If we persuade some of them, we're doing fine. If we persuade most of them, we're true spellbinders and consummate salesmen. But we're not going to sell all of them, I don't think, all of the time. But it's good to remember that that's the name of the communications game, to sell an idea, to get the good people to actually buy what we're selling. Thank you. Do you know the definition of a bore? A bore is a person who won't let us participate in a conversation on an equal basis. We find him dull, tiresome, uncongenial, repetitious. We hate to see him coming. We're delighted when he leaves. It's a curious fact that those who tend to hog the conversation are the very persons who would be much better off, as would the people they know, if they stayed out of it entirely. Good conversation is one of the great joys of human commerce. Good conversation should be like a game of tennis, in which the ball is struck back and forth, with each player participating equally. Bores are like golfers who just keep hitting their own ball over and over and over again. The good conversationalist is one who, after he's held the floor for a minute or so, or has completed saying something he wanted to say, will then, with a well-phrased and directed question, involve another player in the game. He will see to it that the conversation shifts from him to someone else. That is the good conversationalist. And they are so rare, they could hold their annual convention in the back seat of a compact car. We love such people. They're a joy to be around. They're the people we call and invite to dinner, the people we call and ask to join us for lunch. They're the people we like to go fishing or travel with. They're good conversationalists, well-informed, thoughtful, obviously interested in what you have to say, and interesting in the extreme in their turn as they keep the conversation going back and forth over the net. All right. What does that have to do with making a speech? Well, it has a good deal to do with it. In an earlier message, we talked about the importance of feedback, of gauging and testing the audience's reaction to what you're saying, to watch for clues. The good speaker does this in a conversational way, too. He talks with the audience without their having to say a word. He will actually ask his audience questions, such as, "Do you agree with that?" Then he'll pause and watch for clues, for evidence that they either do or do not agree with what he said. Now, that's a form of conversation. It's like the conversation we can have with a small child. He gives us indications of agreement or disagreement. He talks to us in the way of small babies. Well, the audience can talk to us, too, by their silence, by their attention, by their nods and their poking of the person sitting next to them. Yes, by their laughter and by their seriousness at the right places. The good speaker is able to achieve a marvelous give and take with his audience, just as a good conversationalist does with the person he's with. We've mentioned that people in our society desire recognition more than any other factor. Pausing for response of the kind I've mentioned here is a form of recognition. It's looking at your audience. It's really seeing them. It's asking them questions and waiting a moment for a response of some kind. I always tell the man in charge of the lights backstage that I want to be able to clearly see my audience. He can lower the lights. It's a good idea to lower the illumination. It seems to make concentration easier and it's more relaxing. But the light should not be out entirely, nor should there be a bright spot in our faces so that we cannot see the people out there to test and gauge their reactions to what we say. In small meetings, business meetings, and small meeting rooms, the lights can be left alone, but the response I'm talking about here can be more easily seen and read. If they're bored, they'll find ways of showing it, despite their best efforts. If they're interested, they'll show that too, and when we ask a question, they'll respond. That's why the seminar approach is so interesting and often welcomed by the participants. It involves the audience in a very literal and vocal way. A seminar involves a smaller number of people usually and asks for their actual participation in the subject under discussion. Here, the feedback is truly clear and obvious. Unless it's the president of the company or other official, the people in the group are reluctant to challenge for fear of later reprisal of some kind, being passed over for a promotion or some such thing. And that's another reason why the use of consultants is steadily on the rise. A consultant can say the same thing the official of the company would have said, with the difference that he'll get an immediate and very vocal response, which is exactly what is wanted. I rather imagine that a good conversationalist will make a good speaker. He's sensitive to the presence of others. His antennae are forever alert, picking up signals from his audience and involving them in his talk. The bore will also bore an audience. He'll keep hammering away at the same ball over and over again, totally oblivious to the feelings or negative feedback of his audience. Then he's outraged when people begin falling asleep or talking to each other in the back of the room or sneaking out. The good conversationalist husband, on coming home in the evening, will ask his wife how things went during the day before he launches forth with his own trials and tribulations. And he's the kind of person who will listen to his kids before giving them the benefit of his Olympian wisdom. The tennis and golf examples are good ones. They serve to help us to remember to share the conversation equally with the people we're with and pause for feedback and ask questions of our audiences. Standing up in front of a room full of people is something of a responsibility. We're free to handle our subject as we will, but freedom does not mean license to impinge on the rights and feelings of others. We have a duty to be interesting, or we shouldn't get up in the first place. If it's a subject we have to talk on repeatedly, as do sales managers, we have the responsibility to burn some midnight oil, to read, to find interesting material we can weave into our talk so that each one is different from the others in some way, so that they don't become deadly and tedious and dreaded by the sales force. I was delighted at an article that appeared in Toastmasters magazine about me and the way I write my daily radio programs. Written by Catherine Crowley, it pointed out that I have to write 260 radio programs a year. That's 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year. Each of the programs should be of interest, year after year. Now, as I speak these words, in their 17th year. Sometimes it's difficult to find interesting material. It often takes a couple of hours or more of reading and poking about in books, periodicals, and so on, before the germ of an idea appears. Now, that's the task of the speaker. Whether he's manager of the sales force in a car dealership, an insurance agency, real estate office, or a large international organization. When interest leaves, the sell goes out of his message. Watching and listening for the response of the people we're talking to is a good way to find out how we're doing. It's also the mark of a good conversationalist. Thank you.